Derek Jensen is an environmental activist with the DGR, and it's been 2 years since he's been on the program, but we're glad to have him back again. A few months ago, I happened upon a video of him getting harassed by Antifa at a public talk that he gave about the roots of queer theory, its ties with the early founders of the postmodern movement, and their open advocacy of pedophilia in a segment titled Pedophile Jeopardy. I asked him to come back on the program to talk about the implosive cannibalistic radicalization that is destroying left-wing activism. I wasn't aware when I asked him to come on the program, but I was shocked when he explained to me that he had been deplatformed over his criticism of trans ideology and queer theory. Much like Megan Murphy, it is a sad example of a psychologically unhinged fringe movement destroying public discourse. I was aware that there was kind of an argument being made to kind of normalize pedophilia over the years, but I didn't realize that it had those ties to, like, the postmodernists and whatnot, like Foucault. And,
yeah.
And I also have been going through a personal transformation, you know, since the last time we talked, where, I don't know, it's kind of awkward to talk about, but I feel like I've kind of been left behind in some ways. In some ways, I have left the left-wing radical movement of ideas, and then in some other ways, I feel like they've kind of shifted away from some of the things that I fundamentally believed then and still do, you know.
Yeah, like free speech?
Huh. Yeah, like, you know, I think there's a problem with, I think, intersectionalism, really. I think when I had Lierre Keith on, she says she prefers the term multiple oppressions or whatever, but whatever you want to call it. Like, the free speech, the pedophile thing, you know, that's very uncomfortable for me. And also, I'm a big proponent of the Second Amendment, right? And so I'm kind of confused by how they claim that the government has a monopoly on the use of force and at the same time want to disarm, you know, the populace. And there does seem to be a weird separation from, like, the working class that I think has happened. Like, they used to be very much for the working class, and it seems like they just kind of shit-talk them now, you know, like they're infants.
Right.
And, like, there's just a whole milieu of problems, and, like, there's the whole transgender. I still use the word tranny. I'm not giving up the word tranny. But there's that whole thing that kind of seems to have fucked up feminism a little bit.
Oh, completely. That's why I lost my publishers, is because of my critique of queer theory and transgender ideology.
Oh, shit. Well, I think that's pretty fucked up.
Yeah, it's completely fucked up.
The idea of eradicating the age of consent down to the level of an infant is, like, it's insane. I think that's why Foucault is routinely called, like, Dr. Evil, just because of, like, how he looks with his weird baldness. And
yeah, well, there's that plus his promotion of sadism. That doesn't help.
Right, right. And Gail Rubin, you know, that whole, that's very messy, very uncomfortable. And now I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that the normalization of pedophilia thing, they're trying to foist themselves onto the LGBT acronym, you know?
Oh, that's been going on for a long, long time.
It used to just be the gay community, and then it's gay and became gay and lesbian, and then gay, lesbian, bisexual, and then the transgenders were added on, which is kind of weird because that's not something that's rooted in sex. It's rooted in identity, you know, and then it's like QIA plus whatever. I think it's kind of an insult.
Well, there's a strong movement to go. There's a strong movement. There's the one that to get the L out, which is to get the L out of the LGBTQ. And there's also just yesterday or the day before, 22, I believe, bigwigs in the British LGB community wrote a letter denouncing Stonewall UK and saying that they want to form a new organization that's LGB because the T and the Q have destroyed everything, which is what they do.
I guess my main question is just, I mean, I guess I'm more of a libertarian mindset these days, but I don't think it's just that I'm getting older. Okay, I think there has been a demonstrable shift. Like, objectively speaking, I think in many ways the left wing has shifted into a very weird position, and I don't think it's just my state of mind that's shifted. I think something fundamentally within that movement has shifted, and I'm like, what is going on? What happened? Enlighten me a little bit, because I do find it genuinely confusing, not just from a political perspective, but personally, because I get called a Nazi for saying that women, can't be men and vice versa kind of thing. Like,
yeah, it's all really horrifying, frankly. And I'll tell you something I'm really proud of first, and then I'll tell you something I missed. And the thing I'm proud of is in my book Culture and Make-Believe, which came out in 2002, I was really pleased with the way I predicted the rise of the authoritarian right. And so now that the bragging is out of the way, I'll tell you what I missed, which is the rise of the authoritarian left. And I was really caught by surprise by that. And the left that is out there now is almost unrecognizable to me. It is one of the strongest opponents of free speech at this point. And part of the destruction has come through the rise of identity politics and through the rise of call-out culture and also the rise of, frankly, narcissism. There was a study done from 1980 to 2010 that showed that narcissism has increased by like 60% among college students. And the way they use, like, how do you figure that out? Empathy had decreased by 60%. And one of the what they did is they would ask people questions like, so if you have two sandwiches and you're at lunch and your friend doesn't have a sandwich, would you share? And so various questions to judge the empathy, and that's gone down by 60%, like I said, between 1980 and 2010, and most of that decrease happened between 2000 and 2010. And I think we can make a very strong case for that being, for multiple causes, of course, but one of the causes of that would be the rise of the Internet. I interviewed this guy a couple years ago. It was very interesting. It was about how at one point communities were place-based and family-based. You know, you would live in a neighborhood. And, you know, I know when I was a kid that the main people that I played with were, you know, was Jeff and his friends who lived two doors down. And had I lived in a different neighborhood, I would have been playing with Ron and Keith. And nowadays, communities are not place-based, but instead they're primarily, this guy was saying, aspirational-based. And one of the examples he was giving was that instead of playing football or hide-and-go-seek or whatever with Jeff in the neighborhood, these days communities are aspiration-based, which is what he means is you play in a computer game and you can be an elf warrior or a dwarf axeman. And so then you can find other people with similar interests like that and similar aspirations that don't even have to be real, because obviously if you're an elven archer, that's not real. You probably have never picked up a bow in your life, and you're certainly not an elf. But those sorts of identifications become central to our new communities, or you'll find a community of other people who can be males who identify as transgender, or you can find a community online of other people who, and for God's sake, furries, you know, you'll find a whole community of people who...
That entire milieu of individuals, that is like a dumpster fire of identities.
Yeah, and that has been greatly facilitated, if not enabled, or whatever word we want to use, by the Internet. So that's one of the things that's happened. Another thing I think that's happened is, and this is just going to be sort of a catch-all garbage play, but we can tease it out if you want, that at the end of empire, people go crazy. And you see this, you know, the Roman Empire, you see this with a lot of different ends of different types of society.
Camille Paglia talks about that at length in Sexual Personae, about how late stages of culture, that you see a lot of increases in, like, transgenderism, the art becomes more fluid and more feminine kind of stuff, and you see a lot of mental illnesses kind of popping up all over the place.
Okay, there's a great quote by Edward Gibbon about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. I got to try to remember how it goes. He has the five stages. Oh, I'm going to totally butcher this. Five markers of the end of an empire. One of them was basically that art becomes no longer creative, but a parody of itself. Sex becomes really strange, and there's an increasing reliance on the state to take care of you, and a couple others. But I feel like I'm sort of drifting off. Part of the problem with the left is this huge... Well, I'll just tell you what's happening to me is that, you know, I've lost my publishers recently, and I get deplatformed all the time now because of the transgender issue and because I speak out against queer theory. And I've actually done the math, and my published writing about queer theory or transgender issues is 0.17% of my work. That's 0.17 words per 100. That's 1.7 words per 1,000. That's 17 words per 10,000. That's nothing. That would be like in our conversation so far, me objecting to one word that you said and completely flipping out and trying to make it so you never get published again because of that. And that is a cult-like adherence to an ideology.
I don't think it should necessarily matter, even if it was 100% of what you wrote about. You know, this constant need to deplatform people or like deperson them from the internet or whatever just because they espouse views that you disagree with.
I don't disagree with you at all.
No, I'm saying that just...
No. I'm saying in your point, even if it's 100% disagreement, that's fine. You know, you talk and you know, if I don't like what you have to say, I'm probably just not going to go to your talk.
Right.
It's a pretty simple solution all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in college, Edward Teller came to do a talk at my college. Edward Teller, sometimes called the father of the H-bomb, pretty crazy guy. I remember that one of my classes required that we go to it. And we went to it. And honestly, you know, the college was 35 years ago now, and I don't remember a lot of college, but I remember that next day in class as we had a really spirited disagreement in this class about what we thought about Edward Teller. Some people thought he was horrible, crazy atrocity, and other people thought he was pretty smart. And the instructors were doing what instructors at college are supposed to do, which is to not care what our opinions were, but to teach us how to support our position. So if you think that Edward Teller is horrible and should not have been allowed to speak at the Colorado School of Mines, you need to defend that position. And that's great, because as a teacher myself, I recognize I didn't care what my students wrote about. I couldn't care less what they wrote about. What I cared about was how they defended their position.
Well, so as an academic, I guess, do you see, because that is a constant criticism on the right, is that the universities are more concerned with kind of this left-wing indoctrination as opposed to, like, the critical thinking skills that they're supposed to be instilling in the students? I mean, do you see a problem there?
Oh, yeah, I see a huge problem there. And that's, okay, and part of the problem is functional. Postmodernism started with a great idea. It started with the recognition that the winners tell history. And so a lot of the stories we're told are told from, and I'm going to use their language here, but, you know, don't, I have to tell you, as soon as I hear somebody use this language, my mind just turns off because it's so much gobbledygook.
Okay.
But don't turn off because we're going to go through it.
I'm all ears.
So it's all from a Eurocentric, male-centered position. So we hear the history of the Europeans, of how, you know, great it was that Christopher Columbus came over and discovered America. Postmodernism emerged from that understanding that we were being told stories that came from that perspective. That's a great realization. There are other stories that can be told. That's really important. And so let's hear some of those other stories, and let's have sort of a marketplace of competing ideas of, Let's have the Christopher Columbus as a hero story. Let's have the Christopher Columbus was a slaver story. Let's stir the pot with all those. That's beautiful. That's great. I got no problem with that. That's a wonderful thing. The problem is that then postmodern philosophers did what stupid people do, which is they went from the understanding that there are multiple stories that can be used to describe reality, which is great, to then argue that because there are multiple stories to describe reality, there is nothing but stories and there is no reality. And that's remarkably stupid, and it has taken over academia completely. And one of the consequences of that, that's one of the things that has led to the destruction of speech on the left, is that if you adopt postmodernism, the notion that there is no reality, there is only the stories we tell about reality, you can't rely on facts to solve a disagreement, because all there are the different stories. And so the way to win an argument in that case is to shut down the other side. That's the only way you can win. You can't use facts because they don't exist. Instead, you can only shut down the other side by accusing them of being a bigot, by accusing them of being racist, by accusing them of being a transphobe, by getting the university to shut them down. That's the only way a postmodernist can... I've been sitting out here in the sun with the dogs, but there are a lot of bears around, and the dogs get very excited. So I'm going to go back inside and take the dogs so they don't bark. Come on, little pups. Pup-pups, come on, inside.
Inside. Go on, in you go.
And now we got bears all around because there are three bears sitting on the other porch.
And every other morning I put on the National Park live stream, and it's a bunch of bears, you know, in a river, eating, having...
Oh, yeah, the one up in Alaska?
Yeah, and my daughter, she's always like, I want to see the bears. I want to see the bears. And I'm like, all right, chill.
Okay, so that's a problem with inherent in postmodernism, that the only way they can win their arguments is by shutting down all discourse. And then queer theory has the same problem in that queer theory, again, started with a really good idea, which is how did certain things become normalized, especially sexual things? How did it get to be that homosexuality is looked down upon or is prohibited? And that's a great and important question. How did certain forms of sexuality become normalized? How did certain forms of sexuality become stigmatized? And that's great, but unfortunately, because it emerged from postmodernism, they did the same stupid thing that postmodernism did, which is because strictures against homosexuality are wrong, therefore all strictures against all forms of sexuality are wrong. And it's not the rape of children, they wouldn't call it that, they would call it expressions of love between children and adults.
Well, I was noticing that in the coverage of the whole Epstein affair, was that they wouldn't say that the children were raped, like in the news media. They kept using this term, like sex with underage people or like sex with a minor or something. And it's like, I think that's categorical. Like if we're talking about 12-year-olds or something particularly, that's, you know, I think that's categorically rape. It's not like a...
Yeah, it is. But the queer theorists would argue that that is not. And in fact, you're oppressing children by calling it that because you're denying them agency. You are denying that those children, and the queer theorists go as young as toddlers. There's a queer theorist, Pat Califia, who says that if a child is old enough to decide to eat spinach, that child is old enough to decide whether or not to have sex, by which Pat Califia does not mean play doctor with another child.
Wow.
Pat Califia means have sex with an adult. And we know that because Pat Califia has written child torture porn of adults sexually torturing children. So the point is that they would argue that, and I think this is, of course, complete crap, but they would argue that, and they say this explicitly, Allen Ginsberg said that...
Oh, boy. Oh, shit.
Said that those prepubescent children would get used to our lovemaking if only those hysterical adults would stop complaining and stop making the children scared.
Yeah, in that book, The Ayahuasca Letters, it was like a correspondence going on between Allen Ginsberg and William Burroughs. The frank nature in which they're constantly talking about sex with young boys is kind of cringeworthy. And you see that a lot in like Naked Lunch and stuff too, and like other writings of theirs.
Yeah, and the point that I really want to make is that queer theory is arguing, they explicitly argue that they are attempting to destroy the distinction between good and bad sex and what is considered deviant and what is not. And one of the ways I respond to that is by saying, let's queer eating as well as when we're doing that, because eating is natural. They say sex is natural, therefore all forms of sexual are natural and all restrictions are abhorrent. And, well, eating is natural, and I was raised a Seventh-day Adventist as a kid, and so we did not eat pork, and we didn't eat catfish, and we didn't eat shrimp, didn't eat ham, because it says in the Bible you shouldn't. And I still remember when I had my first ham and cheese sandwich when I was 17, and it was delicious. And the point is that if we use the same logic they do, we would say because restrictions against eating ham and cheese sandwiches are silly, therefore all restrictions against all food eating is silly, and therefore why don't I go ahead and eat some hemlock and some manchineel and some loco weed. You see what I'm getting at?
Right.
There are some food restrictions that are in place because it's harmful to eat those things. And I would argue that there are some forms of sexuality, such as the abuse of children, that are harmful. It's like with the postmodernists, though. The queer theorists can't actually argue that position.
Well, at what point do you draw the line, though? I mean, it starts to get into muddy waters when you're talking about, say, like an issue of, like, statutory rape where a 17-year-old has sex with an 18-year-old or something like that. There is a legal definition set in place, but there does seem to be a problem there when it's, like, enforced that strictly.
Well, that's the point. The point, though, is that we can argue, and I have no problem arguing, and that's the point of society, is to argue over what those distinctions are. Over when it is okay and when it's not. And so you and I would agree that it's not okay for a 45-year-old to use neutral language here to have sex with a 2-year-old. You and I agree on that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And we're also going to agree that it's okay for somebody who is 18 years old today to have sex with somebody who is 17 years and 364 days today. We're both going to read that
right?
Okay.
Well, so I think they would hold a different view in Vatican City.
My point is that that's what you do in a society is argue those distinctions. And it's not just that. It's where you can park, you know. We have agreed as a society that you don't park your car in a bus stop. And if you do, then you're going to get a $100 ticket or whatever. And we as a society have agreed that if I take a gun and I'm not going to do this, so my neighbors don't have to worry. This is a pure hypothetical example. If I like my neighbors, fine. If I take a gun and I sneak into my neighbor's house and I shoot them in the head, that I could be arrested for first-degree murder. But we also agree that if they come after me with a machine gun and I happen to be holding a machete and I hit them with the machete as they're trying to shoot me with a machine gun, that won't be murder. The point is, living in a society is living in negotiation, and we come to agree on certain terms, or we don't. We fight them out. And the point is, the queer theory is arguing that all of those restrictions are unacceptable, that if it's sex, it goes. I mean, Judith Butler has argued in favor of parent-child incest. And it's so funny, because not even Judith Butler must read Judith Butler, because Judith Butler argued in favor of parent-child incest, and then a bunch of parents in Brazil got really mad at her. They were yelling at her, how did you do this? And she issued this statement saying, I've never supported parent-child incest, but it's there in her books. It's just nuts. So another part of the problem with, when you mentioned critical theory, this made me think of it. Another part of the problem with critical theory and postmodernism and queer theory, all of those are pretty wrapped together. I find this really interesting. They really emerged from literary criticism and philosophy. And literary criticism is an interesting thing because you're not actually studying a real thing. You're studying a literal text. You're studying something that somebody made up. And so if you're basing a philosophy on literary criticism, what you're doing is taking something that somebody wrote. So it's one step extracted. Now you're criticizing that thing that they wrote and interpreting that thing that they wrote. So you're two levels away from reality, as opposed to in the sciences where you're studying reality and then you're coming up with ways to describe reality. So you're only one step abstracted, which is in many ways as close as we can get. And with literary criticism, there's no way to prove that you're right or wrong. I was just reading an introduction to a novel last night where the novelist, it was Ian Rankin, it was his first published novel, and he said that he wrote it as a 22-year-old or something, and then it was extraordinary a few years later to see it being taught in a class, and all the students were coming up with all this fancy literary theory that he had not intended. He said that he was glad that it was in there, but he respected them seeing it. He wasn't saying they were making it up, but the point is that they weren't examining a physical reality thing. And so I think the big pushback that has to come against postmodernism, queer theory, and trans ideology has to come from the sciences.
I feel like that's been happening, though, and the science is inconvenient for that narrative, which, again, I think ties back into the need to shut down the discourse.
Well, I completely agree with you. That's why the pushback has to come from that. And I have critiques of science, but the critiques of science from postmodernism are all the wrong ones. And so I do have some optimism in terms of the pushback against those ideologies, and that my optimism primarily comes from science. It's extraordinary to me that, I mean, just lately, the whole last 6 months, especially last year, as males who identify as transgender have been forcing their way into women's sports.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of those things that, you know, maybe kind of like you're talking about, like how science pushes back. And it's not even necessarily through its own devices. It's like these, and I was talking to Mary Lou Singleton about this. It's like these, I'm just going to say men who think that they're women are just like totally smashing the record books in women's sports.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're like completely dominating. And it's just so obvious.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was in college, I was a very good high jumper. I went to a small school, and I won that small college championship, broke the school record. I jumped, my best jump was 6'10", and that's very good for a small college. That would not have qualified me for nationals. It is 14 inches below the world record. So this made me a really good jumper, but not an elite jumper. But had I identified as a woman, I would have had the world record. The world record for women has been held since, I think, 1988, and it is 6'10 and a quarter. So I would have been 1/4 inch below the world record. That's crazy.
I think there's a quote by Ludwig von Mises that the praxeology is theoretical and not a historical science and cannot be subject to verification or falsification.
So the person who's saying this, is he saying this as a criticism of the postmodern worldview?
I believe so, yes.
Oh, good. Because I was going to say, if that's them promoting it, like, that's stupid.
Either way, I think it's, whether he was promoting it or not, I think that's correct.
Yeah, I completely agree. Completely agree.
And it's part of that postmodern subjectivity. It can be neither verified, you know, through facts and evidence, which is why they reject it so harshly. It's like no amount of facts and evidence seem to be useful, you know, for the debate.
And unfortunately, this ties in with a very common thing. It's not only postmodernists who refuse to acknowledge physical reality. This happens constantly. I remember when I was writing Culture of Make-Believe, you know, I was thinking a lot about family dynamics, and when I wrote Language All the Words Too. And R.D. Lang had the three rules of a dysfunctional family, which rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. Postmodernism, one of the things it does is it rationalizes denial, and it gives people a structure to maintain their denial. And I keep thinking about this study that was done in the 60s. I can't remember the guy's name right now, but Lester Laborsky, that's it. He attached electrodes to people's eyeballs, and then he would track where they would look, and then he would give them something that they found disturbed their worldview, and there'd be a picture, and their eyes would never once track to the part of the picture that would affect their worldview. And the implication of that is that they would see it out of the corner of their eye, and they would know where not to look. And so right when I was learning about Lester Laborsky, I also read about this case of this guy, the head of the DEA in, I don't know, Colombia or Venezuela, somewhere in South America, was arrested because his wife was smuggling drugs into the United States. And what his wife said, she would be doing lines of coke on the table, and he would walk through the room, and he wouldn't see it. And my point is that this is a common thing. I mean, I used to talk about this in my talks a lot. I would say, so am I the only person here who's ever been in a bad relationship? And everybody laughs. And then I say, so, and if anybody tried to tell me what was wrong in the relationship, I would say, why are you trying to ruin my perfect relationship? You know, we have this sort of built-in denial. And, you know, early on we were talking about how at the end of empires that they get especially crazy. And Joseph Tainter talks about how an empire is built on certain means and certain principles that as the empire starts to fall, what you'll do is you think, well, we just need to do more of what we did before, and that will get us out of it. So if your empire is built on making great stone heads and your empire is starting to fall and your society is starting to fall apart, well, we need to make more great stone heads. And if your empire is built on human sacrifice and that's what propitiates the gods, well, things are going bad. We just need to make more sacrifice. And it's the same with all of this, that postmodernism is really abstraction from physical reality on steroids. And this has been coming for a long time. People have been talking about how alienating modern industrial society is for a long time.
It's kind of funny. That was one of the bedrock principles of Marxism.
Yeah. And so now, are we surprised when these alienated people come up with a philosophy that is so based on alienation that it thinks physical reality doesn't exist at all? Not only are we sort of in denial about physical reality, but we pretend it doesn't even exist. That's in many ways a completely logical endpoint to a society that's been based on body hatred and hatred of physical reality from the beginning. I mean, for crying out loud, the big step in all of this movement away from the body happened when we moved to a sky god, because what the sky god did is it took all the meaning out of the world and it put it way, way out in the stars and way out in heaven. That's the big one. That's the heavy lifting. And then once you've done that, all the mechanistic scientific perspective and also postmodernism in their different ways have done is go ahead and remove meaning from the world altogether. So this is really interesting. I hadn't really thought of it this way before, but Susan Griffin wrote about how fundamental
nature and woman, woman and nature, right?
Yeah. Woman and nature and pornography and silence.
Right.
Anyway, in pornography and silence, she wrote about how fundamentalist Christianity and pornography are two sides of the same coin. That basically, that's the Madonna and the whore. That you have on one side, Christianity wants the soul but not the body. Pornography wants the body but not the soul. And that once the split is the important thing. That's all fine. That's sort of an intro to what I was just thinking now, which is that I've talked before about how the Abrahamic sky god sort of led inevitably to science in terms of removing meaning from the earth. But now I'm thinking, too, that, yeah, science is in opposition to postmodernism, but sort of hardcore mechanistic science and postmodernism are in some ways, and I can't defend this because I just thought of it right now, some ways two sides of the same coin, too.
That's why I guess I tend to fall back on Camille Paglia a lot. But again, like in Sexual Persona, it's kind of interesting you say that because she dichotomizes masculinity and femininity between the sky cult and the earth cult. And you know how women are more internal, whereas men have like external genitalia and go for outward projection and things like that. That's just what comes to my mind. I mean, I thought that was kind of interesting.
Right. Here's the question. What are we going to do to break the hegemony of postmodern thought on society?
Well, I'm kind of curious if it's going, like, because a lot of people, they like to use the pendulum metaphor, right, where, like, the pendulum swings back and forth. But I'm wondering if maybe it's just going to, it's more of an entropic kind of relationship that we have with society right now. Because resources are finite, right? The population is almost at its maximum capacity. I think it's 7 of 9 million. If it's not overdone already.
Yeah, I would argue it's way over.
So I've become a lot more cynical, honestly. And, you know, one of my favorite graphic novels is As the World Burns. And that, again, like in terms of like the climate debate and all that too, like, you know, you kind of talk about in that how even if we were to fully reverse, you know, and just do 100% recycling and all that, it's still, the damage has been done. I'm wondering if it's like we're just kind of declining into dust. And that's going to be it. I don't know about the pendulum thing. I don't see how it could swing back. And if it did swing back, then that's not really a message of hope either.
Well, my sour tone of voice has nothing to do with disagreeing with you because I agree with you. The sour tone of my voice is that postmodernism really destroyed what little faith I had in human sentience. Because it took this great question, and then they quickly turned it into the stupidest possible answer. So my fear is even if the pendulum swings back, it'll just swing back stupidly. I mean, it'll swing back, and they'll come to the wrong conclusion again. The conclusion will instead be that I have no idea.
David Foster Wallace, you know, he wrote a good bit about postmodernism, and I mean, Infinite Jest was, I think, a very round critique of the effects that postmodernism has on the way people think, and which is why I'm kind of ashamed to acknowledge my cynicism, because that is a hallmark of postmodernism. I mean, I'm 31 now, so maybe it's a generational thing, but I feel like my hope is just kind of diminished.
I hear what you're saying, and I want to validate your cynicism in that I think there's two forms of cynicism. One is a completely undeserved, cheap cynicism because it's easy and because the person's lazy and doesn't want to actually do the work. And then there's another one when you have fought and fought and fought, and every time you figure out a way to use their rules to stop an injustice, they change the rules. And that doesn't mean that you quit, but it means you're not stupid and you recognize that every time we succeed, they change the rules on us. And that's a sort of earned cynicism that I think is actually valuable in moving forward. And there's a huge difference. Basically, it's the difference between the cynic who sits on their butt and doesn't do anything and the other person who has been battle-tested and knows what's going on and is really cynical and keeps doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do.
Well, I mean, even if we're able to overcome the social problems that we talk about this whole time, you know, in terms of like postmodernism and all that, the kind of the shutting down of speech, the kind of stillbirth of speech, even if we were to overcome that, then there's still all that other stuff, right?
I totally agree.
Problems with the environment, you know, problems with technology. Oh, I did read Technics and Civilization after that interview, by the way. Fantastic.
Oh, good. Did you like it?
I did, yeah. But, I mean, there's still all those other problems after that. I guess I would ask you, let's just say that we were able to solve that social issue. Do you think that those problems would be easier to overcome?
I'm going to change your language just a little bit. I think they would be slightly less impossible.
Okay.
I mean, it's dire. Things are bad, and that doesn't mean that we sit on our butts. I mean, so long as there's still one blade of grass, you know, one wild insect, one wild bear, one wild anything, I'm going to keep fighting. It's like an environmentalist friend of mine says, we can't predict the future. And so as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure some doors remain open. And what he means by that is as civilization collapses, if bull trout are there in 10 years, they may be around in 100, but if they're gone in 10, they're gone forever. I mean, all the environmentalists I know forever, the real environmentalists, have been hanging on by our fingernails trying to protect this or that scrap of ground to make sure that to basically just carry it on, so not on my watch. It's not going to go down on my watch. After I die, then it may go down or it may not, but it's not happening. I'm not taking responsibility for that. I am taking responsibility for helping it sustain. That's the position we're in, and it's coming to a crisis point. I'm not one of those people who says the civilization's going to crash the next 18 months, but I am one of those people who says it can't last past 2050 or something. And even if it does, I mean, it's like Lear Keith always says, that if there's anybody around 100 years from now, they're going to ask what the fuck was wrong with us that we didn't fight like hell when the world was going down.
Yeah, no shit. Well, I think it's really tragic. You know, I didn't know about all that stuff that had happened to you. I mean, particularly like in terms of your publishers getting pulled and getting deplatformed and all that stuff. And I remember in the email that I sent, it's like, where the fuck have all the good speakers gone? Where is the intellectual talent? You know, where are the Jensens? Noam Chomsky has disappeared off the face of the planet. Michael Parenti, I haven't heard from him in like a decade. Like there used to be a wealth of talent that just they don't speak out anymore and they're gone.
Well, two things. One is I can't speak to Michael Parenti because I don't know for sure. But I know Bob Jensen, for example, is getting deplatformed left and right, no relation to me. And I know others. And there's another part of this that we haven't really talked about that's not very politically exciting but is also true, which is one reason that a lot of speakers have disappeared is because with the economic crash of 2008, a lot of universities lost their budgets to bring people. I know a guy at Chico State who he told me that his budget to bring people prior to 2008 was like $110,000 a year or something like that. And after 2008, it got reduced to $10,000 a year because of the economic collapse. And if you have $110,000 a year, you can bring in a lot of good speakers. But if you only have $10,000, you can't even hardly bring in anybody who's not local because even if he brings me, and even if I don't get paid, which I wanted to get paid when I was doing it, but even if I didn't want to get paid, it's going to be $800 for the plane flight, and it's going to be another $400 for hotel, food, everything for a couple days. So we got $1,200 off the top without even paying me. That's a tenth of his budget. So if I only had a budget for a year of $12,000, I'm only bringing in local people. I'm not bringing in Michael Parenti. I'm not bringing in Chris Hedges. I'm not bringing in Noam Chomsky. I just can't afford it.
Right, right. Well, yeah, I guess, yeah, they're I guess they're of celebrity, right? So they'd probably cost a good deal more. But, you know, I remember when Milo Yiannopoulos, I don't know, I think it was like around 2015, like Milo Yiannopoulos, he was going to go speak at Berkeley, and the students ended up just doing $100,000 worth of damage rioting just to keep him from speaking, you know. I mean,
yeah, at the birthplace of the free speech movement, I wonder.
Right, it's just a bitter irony.
I know. It's like, I don't like him, and, you know, I probably wouldn't go see him, but there's a great phrase about this, which is aggressive fragility.
Well, it's also called, in the parlance of our time, like the snowflake effect.
Yeah. For God's sake, you know, I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, and went to the School of Mines, but during college I still lived at home. And in high school and college, they had all sorts of speakers would come to the University of Colorado, some of whom I really liked. I would go and see them, and it was great. It was fun. And other speakers I didn't like. So you know what I did? I stayed home.
Right, yeah. That's something I think about, like, everyone who, like, complains about offensive content on the internet. It's like, well, don't fucking go there. Who cares? What are you... Turn off the TV or whatever. Just go. You don't have to look at it. You don't have to go view the media, you know.
Okay. Do you like onions?
I do.
Fascist. I don't like onions. I don't like onions. That means you can't eat any onions.
Oh, Christ.
It makes just as much sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, just as little.
I really don't like onions. So if you made me a pizza, it would not be an unreasonable request for me to say, you know, would you mind not putting onions on my half the pizza? That's not unreasonable. On the other hand, if we're having a party where you are going to make 15 pizzas, I'm going to show up, it is completely unreasonable for me to say there can't be any onions on any pizzas. And that's exactly what they're demanding.
Well, I think that's partially what plays into my cynicism, is that given the authoritarian kind of nature of the way all this seems to be going down, I can only predict that there would be something of an equivocal response. You can only do that to people for so long before there's like a violent reactionary effect to that.
I don't disagree.
Was it Antifa members that were criticizing you when you were talking about doing the pedophile Jeopardy?
You know, it's all really amorphous. 10 years ago, they would have called themselves Black Bloc. Now they probably call themselves Antifa.
It's just kind of weird. Like, they're becoming more and more militant. They're actually starting to, like, assault people and stuff like that. There seems to be, like, an escalation in, like, the physical tensions.
The society of the spectacle. You know, a very important line from my own understanding of how things escalate was, I was reading the book And the Band Played On by Randy Schultz. This is back, I read this in the 90s. And the book was about the AIDS crisis in San Francisco in the 80s and how lots of young men were dying and a lot of people were not paying attention. And at one point, he describes a scene in a bathhouse. And Randy Schultz had participated in the bathhouse culture, but he was also critical of it. And there was one line, it's going to be a little bit graphic, very graphic, but one line that really hit me so hard. It was that he's walking through the bathhouse, and he sees some guy sitting in a sling, and he sees what he thinks is an amputee rubbing his stump of his arm against the guy's behind. And then he realizes, oh, crap, this is a guy who has his arm up to his elbow up another guy's anus.
Yeah, late stage culture, man.
Exactly. And the point he makes, which other people have made this point, but this has happened to be where I got it. The point he makes is that if you remove all human connection from sex, if all you have left is the physical stimulation, there's no emotional connection whatsoever. And he's not arguing for monogamy or anything. He's just arguing for some sort of connection. Anyway, if you have no connection whatsoever, then it gets boring. And the physical stimulation has to increase to keep it from getting dull. And this was my introduction to the Society of Spectacle, Guido Bord's thing. And then you see this in the Colosseum, where, you know, you could start off with some smaller things. The spectacle had to get greater and greater and greater to keep people interested. You see this with professional sports. I mean, at one point, you know, the game was enough, and now you've got to have fireworks, and now you've got to have, you know, sausage races, and now you've got to have first a Jumbotron, and now a Megatron, and, you know, next it's going to be a Quasitron or the Googletron or something. You have to keep making the spectacle greater and greater in order to keep that interest. And it's the same with a lot of this nonsensical violence. I have no problem with disciplined militants for a stated and clear goal. I do have a huge problem with mob violence and the euphoria of joint violence for euphoria's sake. I did it in that book that got me canned from the publisher. I also did a critique of the Black Bloc in which I used their words themselves to say, look, we're not actually trying to change anything with this. We're just doing this because it feels good. This feels better than the drugs I had last night. I mean, this is their words, not mine.
Well, I think there's a difference between, like, just randomly attacking people for speaking. Like, I get it if you're literally defending yourself or something to that effect, but the attempt to shut down speech through the use of violence, to me, seems to be the essence of fascism.
I would have to, before I could completely agree with that, I would have to look up the definition of fascism, or you could if you want, either way.
Let's do it, because I guess it is used pretty liberally. Again, this is Wikipedia, so, you know, for whatever, take it with a grain of salt, if you wish. Fascism is a form of radical authoritarian ultranationalism.
Radical authoritarian, yes, I agree with that. Nationalism, no, because the
unless you're talking about like black nationalists, like Black Lives Matter and the black nationalist crowd, they're.
I'm not sure that they would be nationalists. That's an interesting discussion.
The Black Panthers are pretty. They're pretty nationalists, you know, in the tradition of Marcus Garvey and Malcolm X. I guess I could, but that's variable. Again, the intersectional nature of all of this kind of muddies the waters, I think.
Oh, my God. We're having a disagreement. I think that you need to be shut down.
Okay, yeah. Forcible suppression of opposition.
Yeah.
And control of industry and commerce.
No, they don't have control of industry and commerce.
They don't have control, but I think they're going for it. Like, they're trying to shut down Chick-fil-A, right? You know, and, like, they're using cancel culture in order to assert their authority over, like, economic warfare, perhaps.
Is it bad, generically, that they're trying to shut down Chick-fil-A? I mean, haven't boycotts also, I mean, haven't they been used for good purpose?
I'm not 100% clear on what their purpose is, though. Again, it was one person at the head of Chick-fil-A who some time ago donated a small amount of money to, like, a Christian charity or something. I mean, I don't really see it as reasonable. And I can only speculate about how many gay people actually work there and don't give a shit. Boycotts, I think, are very effective, but it's kind of a fine line between boycott and it starts to get into the cancel culture thing.
Here's the thing, you know, it doesn't really matter what precise perspectives you and I take. I think the important thing is these are discussions that need to be had publicly as to when is cancel culture acceptable, when is it not acceptable, is it ever acceptable, is it not ever acceptable, and when are boycotts appropriate and when are they not, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, you know, the whole thing at Evergreen, I was just talking with a friend of mine about this last night. The thing I found extraordinary, well, a bunch of things extraordinary about the thing that happened at Evergreen, but one of them was, and I'm going to sound like an old fart here, but I don't care. When I was in college, yeah, people could protest, but if somebody disrupted a class, they would be, I think, rightfully suspended or expelled. It's one thing to take over the cafeteria. It's one thing to take over an admin building. But when you start disturbing somebody else's attempt to get an education, that's really crossing a terrible line. I cannot imagine the administration, when I was in school, putting up with people marching into my class on fluid dynamics. You know, that has nothing to do with their issue. Marching into my class on fluid dynamics and disrupting the class. I can see that campus police would have been called immediately, they would have been removed, and they would have been suspended for disrupting class. I was on a scholarship when I went to school, but I still figured out I almost never cut classes. And the reason I almost never cut classes is because I did the math, and had I been paying somebody, the school was paying, $25 an hour for me to be sitting in class. And
wow.
Like, and this is back in the 80s when it was pretty cheap. So now you got to figure at Evergreen, I've never done the math, but I'm making up, it's probably $100 an hour for the students. They're actually paying good money for this.
Well, a lot of them are going. A lot of them or their parents, which is another tragedy. A lot of them are going into debt just to be there.
Exactly, they're going into debt, and they don't even get to experience the classroom that they were paying for. They got ripped off for that hour. I know that that sounds trivial compared to the larger social justice complaints, but it's like,
I don't think it's that trivial. And you know, I believe that whole Evergreen stemmed from an instance where, just speaking in terms of boycotts and things of that nature, they were asking white people not to attend for the day.
Right.
And it was that was moving. The whole Brett Weinstein thing. And it's like, that feeds into the narrative that, like, which I hate because, like, I'm biracial, and so I've been witness to how black people can be especially racist sometimes. And it plays into that, what to me is a bullshit narrative that, like, black people can't be racist. And when you criticize that, then it makes you a racist somehow. And, there's a whole gamut of problems that was going on with Evergreen.
You know, I keep thinking, through this whole conversation, I keep thinking of 2 decades ago when I interviewed George Gerbner. He was the TV violence guy. You know, when they say there's 17 acts of violence per hour or whatever they say, he was the guy who did those studies starting in the 50s. And a couple of things. One is he said that everybody misinterpreted what he was really trying to get at, but that's not the real point. The real point is that he said that he thinks the answer to media consolidation and the answer to corporate control of the means of communication was for more free speech. And he, by the way, earned his bones. In World War II, he dropped into German-occupied, I think, Czechoslovakia to fight the Nazis, or Romania, somewhere in there, one of those countries.
He fought, like, actual Nazis.
Yeah, fought real, capital N Nazis, World War II. I mean, he made his bones flying in behind enemy lines. And when I interviewed him in the late 90s, he said, look, let Nazis talk. And then what you do is you disagree with them, and you show how you disagree, and you show how their ideology is terrible. And he said what he believed there should be is a wide range of voices being heard, including some that are incredibly odious. Then what you do is you say, wow, it's like, This is one of the things that kills me. I have never tried to shut down a queer theorist. I've never tried to get them deplatformed. And part of the reason I don't get them deplatformed is because I want them to talk, because what they say is really stupid, and I'm going to use it. That's how discourse is supposed to work.
Well, I personally enjoy debate. It's a very positive way to exercise mental reasoning. And classically through debates, it's like you each gather facts and evidence for your side of the thing, right? And then you come together and you hash it out and hopefully come to an understanding. Or, you know, if not, then, you know, whatever. But at least the debate was had, and at least the people witnessing it would be able to make up their own minds for themselves. Now it just seems particularly one-sided.
That's fascist. I'm kidding.
I know. I have to look up the definition of fascism again. I forgot in the last 2 minutes. You know.
The definition of fascist is anybody who disagrees with me.
Right, they're a troll, right, or a fascist or something. Well, that's kind of part of the angst that I feel, you know, with this with what's been going on. Because, like, rather than, like, picking a team, which is what I used to do, I had a team, right, and I would just chant slogans and propaganda for the team. Coming out of that, it's like now I have to, like, look at what people say and be like, well, I don't agree with that, but I do agree with this. And so I find myself allied with people that I wouldn't have in the past on certain issues, which is confusing at times.
Well, yes. I want to say a few things. One of them is that's called being an adult. And the second thing is years and years and years ago, I used to read reviews of my work. I don't do it anymore. And one review I read, one person said something about my work that I just loved, which is he said at some point in Derek Jensen's career, everyone is going to hate him. Because he refuses to follow their ideology. So they're going to love him. It's like, oh my God, Derek, you wrote a language other than the words. It's so nice. I love that book. Now it's culture make-believe. Oh my God, you betrayed me. Or they love those two books. And it's like, oh my God, you betrayed me with Endgame.
I think it's important to have a healthy contempt for the audience. I mean, I come from art and music. That's my main background, you know. And I think there has to be a healthy contempt there. Because they will turn, certain people will turn on you. And you're eventually, if you say enough, people are going to disagree with you at some point.
Well, and that's good. You know, it's like I was a big UFO fan, not UFO like the things, the band UFO. I was a big UFO fan in the late 70s, early 80s, and some of their songs stunk. And, you know, I like a lot of what Mumford, I love a lot of what Mumford says. You know, there are some things I disagree with. The horror. And then the thing about allies, there's a story that I tell that I just love, which is back in the early 90s, I was up getting firewood in the National Forest, and my truck got a flat tire, and I looked at the spare, and I hadn't looked at the spare in years, and the spare's flat. I go, oh, crap, I'm not going to walk out of here. So I'm driving down the road, thumping along at 1 mile an hour, and I get to this guy's house, and I ask him if he's got a pump I can borrow, and he says, no, but I got a tire you can borrow. So he gives me a spare tire. I drive home and get my tires fixed, and then I'm going to go back up and take him back his tire, and then I also take him a cake. My mom made a cake for him. So I take that up, and he says, hey, that's so nice of you. You know, why don't you come in and have a piece of cake? So I go in, and he's got chainsaws all over his walls. He's clearly a logger. So we're just chatting and eating the cake, and that's all fine. He says, hey, you know, I got plenty of wood out back. You want me to just cut you some wood and toss in the back of your truck? I said, sure, that'd be great. Thank you so much. So we walk out back. He's holding the chainsaw, and he says, by the way, what do you do? I say, I'm a writer. And he says, what do you write? I'm thinking, oh, crap. Science fiction, fantasy, romance. But I'm a terrible liar, so I say, you know, I'm writing a book right now about how the big four timber companies got their land illegally from the public domain.
Yeah, that's a little awkward.
Yeah, he turns red in the face. I'm looking for a break in the fence, and it takes me about 20 seconds to figure out that he's an independent logger who's been put out of business by Plum Creek. He hates the company even worse than I do, and it takes us another 20 seconds before we got our arms around each other's shoulders just swapping stories of how much we hate Plum Creek Timber Company. And we're chatting for a little while, and then we come up with this plan. It's like, okay, we're going to take down Plum Creek. And I say, you know, I'm against all industrial logging, and once we take out Plum Creek, I'm coming after you. And then we both just laughed our asses off because we both knew that taking out Plum Creek was the job of a lifetime, and that even though I am against all industrial logging and he is an independent forester, he is so not my problem. So I love that story because, oh, here's one more story. So there was a publicist for a publisher that I had who set me up to do a radio interview You know, I do a lot of radio interviews where I don't even know what's going on. This is one of them. I call up. Somehow they had set me up to do the Pittsburgh Pirates post-game show.
And,
whoa. Yeah. And we're both professionals. So I call up. It's like, hey, this is Derek. He says, okay, yeah, it's great. This is Pittsburgh Pirates post-game show. I like baseball, but I haven't watched the game. And we quickly figure out, you know, I'm an environmentalist. He's a sportscaster guy. What are you going to talk about?
Yeah, it kind of seems a little odd.
Yeah, so we have to fill 15 minutes, and we figured out quickly that we talked about the fact that a lot of people in Western Pennsylvania like hunting, and I love wild animals, and we were talking about how much environmentalists and animal rights activists should work with hunters to protect wild places. And then when the hunters go in to hunt, the animal rights activists can say, well, we're going to sabotage your hunt because we don't like it. But in the meantime, we're going to help you protect habitat so there's more animals for you to hunt and for us to protect. You know, this is politics. That's all it is. It's finding ways. You know, you find the places you agree on, you find the places you disagree on, and then you go forward.
Well, see, I do find there is some complication, though, with, like, the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of thing. There are people who claim to be fighting for you, right, and then they expect you to uncritically embrace their ideas or praxeology or whatever. And that, to me, is kind of cringeworthy sometimes, you know. Like, the idea of allies, that's another term that seems to have kind of entered the popular language in terms of, like, activism and stuff lately, in the last, like, 5 years or so. The concept of allies, something about that bothers me.
I think it's because what allies means is you need to be slavishly subservient to my ideology.
Right. I'm not into that.
Yeah, and me neither. And, you know, I was doing an interview for my Resistance Radio a few months ago about removing dams on the Lower Snake. And I am also opposed to fish hatcheries. And at one point, I asked the person I was interviewing, so let's talk about fish hatcheries and how terrible they are. And she said, you know, I can't really because I work with a lot of commercial fishermen, and so part of the deal is that we're working together to take down these four dams on the Snake, but part of the deal is I'm not going to trash hatcheries because the commercial fishermen like them and we're allies. And I said, great, that's wonderful, we won't go there. I mean, she was just very clear and direct about it. It was perfectly fine. She had fine boundaries. And when that allyship is over, when she's not working with them, then she'll go ahead and trash hatcheries. Or I'll just talk to somebody else about trashing hatcheries.
Right. Well, I guess you're doing that now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's part of it, is this notion that if you are a member of a subgroup that is oppressed, that is genuinely oppressed, and we're not arguing that the subgroup is not genuinely oppressed, that means that somehow any individual in that group can never do anything horrible, and that group collectively can never do anything horrible, and that's just absurd.
That was Derek Jensen with the DGR. There's a link to his website, derekjensen.org, in the description. His new book, Voices of Resistance, Thought to Exist in the Wild and Other Essays, can be found and purchased there. And I would implore you to do so, since he's been subject to the censorious deplatforming efforts of those who oppose the free spread of ideas. This is John here, once again, with Visions of Color Audio Zine. Take care, and stay frosty.